Okay.
There was a request for Barco, so if anyone wants to make a donation, you can keep that in.
Good morning. Despite the fact that I agree with Batya that it's an important topic, it's a little strange for me to give 5 weeks about Christianity and Islam in a base medrash. It's sort of counterintuitive. The Rav once told me that we should strive to. I mean, Rav Soloveitchik was telling me that we have to strive for Torah in the broadest sense of the term. I'm not sure if that was included, but we'll try to make it as Torah-dick as possible. It is true. This is an area that everybody's equally uninformed about, and it provides the subtext for much of the life in which we live, even in Israel. And even despite the fact that here in Israel, those of us who grew up in the States or grew up abroad in the Western world, bounded by Christianity, Christians are pretty much not a function of our daily life. It's more Muslims, and that's what we'll talk about in 2 weeks. But nevertheless, the Christian world still very much impacts upon us, and the recent UNESCO vote is not an insignificant part of that. What I want to do is as follows. I give a course like this that takes a year, so obviously we're going to be doing highlights here. What I want to do today is I want to talk about a little bit about Jesus himself and about who he was as a Jew or not as a Jew. We're going to jump fairly quickly then to Christianity, because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter who Jesus himself was or what he believed. It matters what Christianity, in all of its many, many various manifestations, think he was. And that's really the important part. If you think that the manipulations of the internet are new, they're really not. They're just sort of like what always was, but on steroids. It's not important what happened. It's important what people think happened. Countries have gone to war on what they thought happened, not what really actually occurred, which usually comes out like 50, 60 years, 100 years later, if that. And then we're going to talk about, that'll be today. Next week we're going to talk about how the major lines that we outlined today sort of morph ages thematically, because obviously we can't cover 2,000 years worth of history. And then we will, most of the time next week we'll discuss how Judaism viewed Christianity, which also went through various stages and depending and times and where we stand today. The third week, if there's anything left to say, again in the survey, on this topic, we will finish it, and then we will go over to Islam. There we will go into a little bit more detail, simply because it's much more aktuali in terms of our own daily lives, and that's a really case of reading, of knowing how to read the paper, because we'll find out in sessions 3 and sessions 4 that all the code words that pop up in terms of Jewish Muslim or Israeli Muslim relations or lack of relations can only have to be deciphered, and then finally we'll get to we'll sort of sum up in the last session, sort of bring it all together and see where we are today. Okay, let's start with sources number one. Oh, by the way, I'll give you one of my emails. If you want more material, I've got tons. Okay. It's Wolf wolfj@gmail.com. By the way, this is called a kruchit. For those who don't know, it's not called a shtudel, it's called a kruchit. They only use that word on the radio because there is still, you're aware of the fact that there's still a commissar of the Hebrew language who works in Rishut HaShidor. She's very good. They're terrified. I mean, I know because I spend, you know, I do a little bit of, I have a little experience in the media, and there's a commissar who sits there and listens to what the broadcasters say, and she writes, the head one's name is Ruth Algamagor Ramon, and she has all kinds of other, you know, like underlings, and they immediately call up and say, you said SMS, you didn't say Misron, or you said Aplikatsia, you didn't say Yisumon, and they start shaking, and it's really very interesting to watch. Anyways, by the way, it changes things, because in the end, words that we were told as kids have come back into usage. For example, I was told when I was a kid how do you say last night? You say emesh, but nobody says that. How do you say last year? Eshtakad, but nobody says that. But the truth of the matter is that they do say it, because The broadcast, right, so I've heard actually conversation, not just, you know, fancy Feinschmecker type, you know, intellectuals, use the words eshtakad and emesh, because even chafetz, which is, you know, like the ultimate word to avoid, sort of has made something of a comeback, so you never know. Okay, let's start with Jesus. As I said, who he was per se is not that important, but it's important for us to know for ourselves. It's here when it comes to talking to Christians, because they have their own belief system. It's hard to know exactly who he was, because everything that we know about him has been sort of has been run through a Pauline prism. The person who really founded it, as we know it, was another Jew whose name was Paul of Tarsus. Tarsus is a Hellenistic city on the eastern Mediterranean coast. It goes back and forth where who it belongs to, Lebanon, Turkey, depends, Syria. He was going to recast the story of Jesus' life and the significance of his death, more importantly, and his theories ultimately became Christianity. He died in 65. He was actually executed in 65 by the Romans. All of the Gospels, which are the major sources of our knowledge about his life, were written afterwards, after his theology pretty much took hold. And everything was run through a Pauline prism in order so that the story could, in fact, fit the theology. There are four sources of his life. They're called the Gospels. They're called the Gospels because the word in Greek for the stories of Jesus' life is Evangelion. Evangelion means the good news. The good news, Jesus died for your sins and was resurrected and so on and so forth. That morphed into different versions. In German, the good news is Gute Spiel. And in English, that becomes Gospel. There are four evangelists. These people tell the story of Jesus' life: Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. The most literarily coherent and the least reliable historically is John. So we're going to leave that aside. All of the movies, all of the, you know, the greatest story ever told, and all these other bombastic, you know, Jesus stories are all basically reworks of John because it was edited. It's a much easier book to read. I had this funny situation last spring. I got a call from Herzl, actually, from Herzl Hefter. How would you like to be interviewed about Jesus? I said, all right, listen, it's not a topic with which I'm unfamiliar. Turns out that there was this Jewish guy who was, I can't remember his name now, although he's supposedly famous. There's this Jewish guy who was doing on a mini-series that was put out by Dino De Laurentiis in the late 70s, and he was back to sort of like retrace his steps during the time the thing was being filmed 40 years ago, and he wanted to re-explore his Jewishness at the same time, and I was one of the guides. All right. So we met at the Kotel, and we were talking all kinds of things. This was the Smithsonian's channel. It's supposed to come out eventually. I don't know when. And it was really weird because we were standing in Rachlat HaKotel, and the interviewer was asking both of us to talk about, you know, how we feel about Jesus and that he was here and whatever. And I'm getting yelled at by like Shas guys who heard, all they had heard was the word named Jesus, and he's screaming at me. It was very odd. Anyways, but that series also, which is on YouTube if you want to see it. Guy's name is Robert something or other, is based on John. The three Gospels that are really considered to be, if we can know anything, to be have any historical validity are Mark, Matthew, and John, and Luke, all of which were written sometime between the year 90 and the year 100. None of them were written by eyewitnesses to Jesus' life, apparently, but they're based on written and oral descriptions of his life. And I, for one, am a bit in oral tradition and its reliability. I personally think you can really get a sense of who he was if you carefully try to sort of peel away the theological stuff from the text and get down to brass tacks. So who was he? I mean, bottom line, and I checked, and I will tell you that I'm about to tell you, I checked, not recently, but not long ago, with my teacher and colleague and dear friend, Professor David Berger, who is the world's expert on Jewish-Christian relations and Jewish-Christian polemic. So the deal is like this. Jesus was definitely born. He was probably a Galilean. He was probably born in Nazareth. The whole story about Bethlehem was invented in order to get him to be born in Bethlehem so he could be the Messiah. He was probably born in Nazareth. He was probably born around the year 3-5 BC. Now it's going to sound a little weird. How come Jesus is born? See, because basically the way that our calendar or the way that the general world counts the years was created by a monk in some Savorfina place in Europe, adding up all the years, and he just made a mistake. So we're stuck with a mistake. But Jesus was born 3-5 BC. He was crucified around the year 33 CE. If you look at his overall trajectory of his life, it's not an unusual life for a person in that time. He was a charismatic preacher. He preached repentance. He preached the imminent end of the world. At the beginning, he probably didn't even think he was the Messiah. That probably was started among his disciples, who then later sort of convinced him that he might himself be the Messiah. He did not think he was the Son of God, although, you know, his mother probably thought he was. You know the joke. How do you know Jesus was Jewish? He lived with his parents till he was 30. He went into the family business. He thought his mother was a virgin, and his mother thought he was God. So that's the way that you know that he was Jewish. Anyways, he really thought he was a rebel or a pacifist or whatever. You can argue that out. It's not 100% clear. But there were many people like that. It was a period of tremendous religious ferment and tension. There were tons of messiahs or would-be prophets floating around. Pilate himself was crucifying them by the dozens. Along the banks of the Jordan and everywhere else. John the Baptist is a typical figure in terms of this, so he's not that unusual in that regard. Why his message took off and others didn't is another question, which is not really for us right now. What's important for us to ask at the moment is, where was he on the Jewish scale? In other words, don't forget, this is a period of let's call them denominations. What do they call them now? Streams? They're streams. You had the Sadducee stream, the Pharisee stream, and you had the unaffiliated stream, and then you had the I want nothing to do with any of you stream. Those are the people living in Qumran. But and the average Jew who just, you know, didn't know from Chochmas. He, you know, he did what he could do, and he didn't know much, and he was an Amaretz, in many, many different ways. And even among the elites, people are floating back and forth between Qumran and the Pharisees and Sadducees. Nothing is really very stable. One of the interesting things that my friend Professor Larry Schiffman points out is one of the things that everybody seems to agree on is who was a Jew. Because of all of the material from the Dead Sea Scrolls and elsewhere and from rabbinic literature that the various groups argue about, who is a Jew is not a question, which is really quite a striking thing. So where was Jesus on the scale? Was he with the Sadducees? He wasn't upper class. He wasn't a Kohen. So that's, we can leave that. Did he believe in the Torah Shebaal Peh? Was he more or less a Pharisee rabbinite type? Was he Qumrani? This is the kind of question that scholars argue about. I think personally, and this is what Professor Berger confirmed to me, that he was sort of like a Pharisee fellow traveler. He wasn't 100% happy with what all the Prussian did, and so on. But nevertheless, he was within that world of Torah Shebaal Peh, and I'll try to prove that to you in a minute or so. That means that Jesus himself, in his life, was personally observant, believed in the binding nature of the Torah, and there is no reason to think that he thought that was going to change. There is this one statement in which Jesus says, not one jot or tittle of the law will pass away. Jot or tittle is basically kotzo shel yud. Okay, now when the kotzo shel yud is going to pass away until the end time. That is in stark, we'll see in a minute, it's a very, very, very stark contrast to what Paul thought. We're going to get to Paul in a few minutes. Paul was of the opinion that with Jesus' death, all bets are off, and the Torah is no longer operative in the way that we know. Okay? All mitzvot are batal. No more ceremonial law, no bris milah, no kashrus, no Shabbos, no nothing. We'll see in a minute why that is. And that Jesus knew that in advance. So that all of that, so that when you take Jesus' life story and run it through that Pauline prism that I mentioned before, okay, conclusion you'll take away is almost the opposite of what Jesus himself apparently felt. So, in addition, the New Testament didn't know anything about Judaism. So when they read texts that they didn't understand, they also understood them in Pauline terms. I'll give you one example, and then we'll look at this case. It started being edited probably after the temple was destroyed in 85, 90, something like that. Don't forget the temple was destroyed in 70. I'll give you an example. Has anybody been to Rome? Mm-hmm. Been to Rome? What's on the papal seal? What's on the papal flag? You ever noticed? There's a big crown, and there is also a pair of crossed keys. Okay. What's the keys? Why are there keys? So I'll tell you the keys of the kingdom. What's pshat? I had to have something based medrash here, right? What's pshat? Pshat's like this. In the book of Matthew, Simon Peter, the fisherman, the leading, ostensibly the leading disciple of Jesus, Jesus says to him, "You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the forces of hell shall not prevail against it, and I give you the keys of the kingdom. That which you will bind on earth will be bound in heaven, that which you will loose on earth, you shall be loose in heaven." Yeah, sounds pretty amazing. And that is the basis for the papal assumption that they can say things and do things and, you know, and make dogma and all kinds of, okay. Fantastic. How do you say bind in Hebrew?
Break.
Hmm? To tie. No, bind. To bind. Look, sure, or another way. Another way. Okay, give me another one. No. Ken, Lesor. Okay. How do you say to untie?
Latir.
Yafe. So nu. So he said, everything that you are oser on earth will be asur in heaven. Everything which you are matir on earth, will be mutar in heaven. What became the great papal, keys to the kingdom really was Jesus gave him smicha. When you are smicha rav, you say yore yore, yadin yadin. Yore yore is beisur veheter. He basically gave him smicha. He says, you can be a rabbi now. Okay. So that you're talking about a situation in which, so how did the papal doctrine grow up? Because they didn't know what they were talking about. The initial meaning of the words got lost, and they said, oh, this must be what this means. So that's an example of how the reading the same text can lead. If you read it through Jewish glasses, you'll get one answer. If you read it through general glasses, you get another example. And that's what I want to show you, right here. In Matthew 12, there are parallels in the other Gospels, you have the following story. At that time, Jesus went to the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain to eat. Okay? What's the problem? Shabbos. So therefore they're kotzer. I'm gonna fall into Ashkenaz, can't help it. And this is kotzer. By the way, this is not an unusual action. People snacking on the heads of wheat was the normal snack in the ancient period. That's called hakoseset hachita. There's even a long sugya in brachas. What bracha do you make on untreated chita heads? Okay, so that's what you do. That's how they snacked. So they were hungry, so they snuck on and broke off some whatevers, and they were kotzer. No, by the way, notice, did Jesus do it?
Yep.
No, the Talmidim. Yeah. But when the Pharisees saw it, there were Pharisees there. They said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." And he said to them, so what did they say? Your Talmidim are being Michal Shabbos. Okay. So he said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence with lechem upon him, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests? Or have you not read in the law how in the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are guiltless? I tell you, something greater than the temple is here, and if you had known what this means, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless, for the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." So he pulls together all kinds of examples of places where Shabbos doesn't count and a higher cause. And I'm telling you, the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath. Son of Man in Pauline language means the Son of God. So in other words, I gave you Sabbath. I decided to be mevatel Sabbath. And this is in fact one of the central texts which are used by Christian theologians to show that Shmir Shabbos has become null and void with the advent of advent and death of the Messiah. Yes, sir. That's one way to read the text. Now let's read it again. At that time, when is that time? So just before that, Matthew describes how he had been, Jesus was being chased by Herod Antipas, the son of Herod the Great, who was the ruler of Tiberia. He wanted his head, just like he got, John the Baptist's head. So in other words, he's running away for his life. He went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, disciples were hungry, they began to pluck heads of grain to eat. Jesus himself didn't do it. And the Pharisees, like the little ladies on the bus that tell you that the kid needs a hat, we should have brought water. You know, it's always somebody, that fruma there is going to say, see, they're Michal Shabbos. So he said to them, now, what's odd, if he had said, for the Son of the Lord, Man is Lord of the Sabbath, right afterwards, that would have clinched the point. But notice what he says. Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, and those who were with him? David Melech was running away from Shaul. He came to Nov. They were there, Shaul's, Doeg HaAdomi was right on their tail, right? And the Kohanim, I forget which Kohen it was, gave him Lechem upon him to eat, and he gave him Cherev Goliath HaGiti, which had been kept in Nov. Nov, but for our purposes, not the one in the Golan, it's somewhere in the area of Yerushalayim, Kidron. Okay, yes, sir. So he was given lechem upon him, even though lechem upon him is only supposed to be given to the Kohanim. Okay, that's number one. Why would that be? What was the justification? Pikuach nefesh. Pikuach nefesh trumps mikdash. Let's call it that way, or trumps korbanos. Or have you not read in the law how on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are guiltless? It's true. The avoda Beit HaMikdash requires actions which are technically Chilul Shabbos. Starts explicitly. You have to shecht and you have to burn and you get all this other stuff. And you're in a situation like those, you know, anybody who was in Shevut HaBitachon at any time knows, in this weird situation where while you're in the tank or while you're in the Nayedet or whatever, you're doing everything under the sun, you shut the thing off, and then you go back in the house and you can't put the lights on. That's the kind of life that the Kohanim lived in Beis HaMikdash. But you see that sometimes Mikdash trumps Shabbos. Okay? So good. So what happens when you put these two psukim together? Pikuach nefesh trumps mikdash. Mikdash trumps Shabbos. Ergo, pikuach nefesh trumps Shabbos. He's giving us a limud, which would be acceptable to a prushi based on psukim to prove that pikuach nefesh doche Shabbos. In other words, the dialogue that's going on is not I'm bringing you all kinds of cases where Shabbos doesn't count. No, he's in language of the prushim on the he's broadcasting on the same wavelength to prove a halachic point. It's an internal rabbinic discussion, and then he says, "I tell you, something greater than the temple is here." And if you had known what this means, I desire rasiti chesed chafatzti below zebach. In other words, don't be so chachnyot. You know, suffering the pashas doches the Shabbos, right? You would not have condemned the guiltless because it's mutter what they did. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath means, you know, the story about Hillel on the roof. Kedai kazel lechalel lavet haShabbat. Sometimes chaye adam trump Shabbos. That's another way to interpret exactly the same passage with totally different results. Now, am I making am I on something? I mean, did I make something up here? Take a look at the Gemara in Yuma. The Gemara in Yuma, Daf Pehei Amud Aleph Tamid Beis, discusses the question of how, everybody knows Bikuach Nefesh Doche Shabbos, but the Amoraim, the Tanoim and the Amoraim here are trying to figure out, alright, whence do we derive it? Which is not, it's called a Midrash Mekayim. We have a halacha, you don't know where it's derived from, so they Medrash Halacha spends a lot of time trying to figure out exactly where it comes from, and what you choose actually is important. Which pasuk you choose is actually important because it tells you something about the nature of the law that you're deriving or that you're trying to understand. Ukvar haya Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, mahalchem baderech. V'levi hasadav, Rabbi Yishmael ben Osher, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, mahalchem achareihem. So that's a whole retinue. Nishala she'lazo bifnehem. Minayin lepikuch nefesh edochet ha-shabbat. Na Rabbi Yishmael va'amar. Im b'machteret yimatzei haganav uka, ein lo damim. Uma ze shesafek ba'al ha-mamon ba, safek al nefashot ba. ושפיכות דמים מטמאה את הארץ וגורם לשכינה שתסתלק בישראל, ניתן להצילו בנפשו, קל וחום לפיקוח נפש שדוחה את השבת. In a situation where suffic pikuch nefesh, and you're allowed to kill for purposes of, to save your life, to kill somebody for purposes of, to save your own life, like that, obviously Shabbos, you don't have Shabbos. I don't want to go into every single yelfusi here. That's one answer. Na Rabbi Akiva. It says, "V'chiyazid ishal reyehu lahorgo b'orma lod meim mizbechi tikachenu lamut meim mizbechi velo me'al mizbechi." Okay, we take away from mizbeach, but not for things above the mizbeach. Okay. V'amar Rabba Bar Barchana Mar Yochanan. I'm sorry. I'll skip to the bold. Umaze shesafek yesh mamash bedorav shein tzafek bedorav va'avoda docha Shabbat. The Gemara has exactly lahavdil alef avdalos, the argument that is preserved here. That's that same syllogism. Okay, and then Nana Rabbi Elazar v'amar uma mila shiachad mimatayim v'arba'im u'shmonei v'arim shabadam dochet haShabbat dochet haShabbat because of bris mili have on Shabbos. Kal v'chomer l'kol gufo shadochet haShabbat. And then you have Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, Omer, Rabbi Shatotai Tishmoru, Yechol Omar, Talmud Lomar, Ach, Halek. Sometimes you are Shomer Shabbos, sometimes you're not. What's the Ach? The Ach is to cover Pikuach Nefesh. Rabbi Yonatan ben Yosef, Omer, Ki Kodesh Hilachem, Hi Misura Biyadchem, Velo Atem Misurim Biyada. It's an echo of the last verse there. Rabbi Shimon ben Yemenasi, Omer, Veshamru ben Yisrael, the Shabbat, Amrat Torah, Chalil, Lav Shabbat Achat, Kidei Shishmor Shabbatot Harbei, that's the one we hear a lot about, but Amar Rav Yehud, Amar Shmuel, I Havai Hatam, if I'd been there, Hav Amina, I would have said, Didi Adifa Miditu, I got the best answer, V'chai Bahem, V'lo Shibia Yamut Bahem, that's the one we paskin like, Amar Rav, L'chulu, Itlei Pircha, Rav says they all have an answer, they can all be countered, except that of Shmuel, Delet Le Pircha, and that's why we paskin, V'chai Bahem, V'lo Shibia. Okay? So you see that just by enlisting the parallel passage in the Gemara, you see that there's an echo in what we have here. So Jesus, the original Jesus, was a Pharisaic fellow traveler who thought the end was coming. He may have thought he was the Messiah. In fact, there's every reason to think at the end he thought he was the Messiah because he was crucified. Because crucifixion was reserved for traitors, reserved for rebels. The Romans had all kinds of ways of killing people. I mean, they were very good at it. I mean, there's a line in Masada in which Peter O'Toole, who plays Flavius Silva, says, "Give us our due, man. We know how to kill." They were very good at it. Mm-hmm. Crucifixion was reserved for rebels and for traitors. That's why at the end of Spartacus, they crucified all the Spartacus' men all the way from Rome all the way down to Apulia because there were so many of the, because they had rebelled against Rome. If you read the story of the crucifixion, Jesus was crucified, between two brigands. What's a brigand? A brigand is he's a highwayman. No, that's what, if you're in charge, the guy that's fighting against you, he's a brigand. If you recall the struggle in Soviet Jewry, how do you call a person who fights for human rights in the Soviet Union? A hooligan. Okay? Depends how you look at it. So, Josephus consistently calls the zealots brigands. There's the listim. That's the, and in fact, when Chazal talk about listim, it's never quite sure, it's never quite clear who you're talking about. Is he really talking about highwaymen? Are you talking about, gladiators? Are you talking about freedom fighters? It's never quite, you know, it's a multi-purpose word. Okay. So that's beginning and the end. Okay? Very nice. There were a lot of other people like him. What changed was, What changed was two things. First of all, I'm sure there were many people who wished or hoped that Jesus was the Messiah on that one Pesach. But he got killed, and there's no room for a Messiah who dies before he fulfills his mission. So most of them probably went home and took two Prozac, and they had the Pesach, and that was that's all there was. There was always a certain number of people who can't make peace with the objective reality, and they insist, despite all objective indications to the contrary, that in fact the Messiah is still the Messiah, and nothing has really changed. We just didn't understand how things are supposed to work. And if this sounds like other episodes in Jewish history, and even more recent Jewish history, you can, in fact, it's precisely what I'm driving at. That is called cognitive dissonance, where the outside reality and your inside reality are clash. Generally, people will adapt their inside reality and convictions to the outside reality, but to outside facts, but there's always a number of people who work the other way. So that the question among those disciples of Jesus who survived, who were left behind, what do we do now, led to, first of all, the development of the idea that he was resurrected. That's a very quick way to get him back on the scene. And then to the deeper question of what does all this mean? And into that niche came a man whose name was Paul of Tarsus. Paul never met Jesus. He came ostensibly to learn, study with Rabban Gamliel, so he said, from Tarsus. He had a very, very good Greek education. The verdict is still out as to how much Jewish education he had, because he only quotes the Bible in Greek, not in Hebrew. Rabban Gamliel, who was the son of Hillel HaZaken, and the head of the Prushim at the time, he describes his life in the Book of Acts, or his life is described in the Book of Acts. He actually was anti-Christian, and then at some stage of the ball game, as he claims he went on his way to Damascus, a conversionary experience in which Jesus comes to him and says, and he knocks him off his horse and makes him blind, and says, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And Paul changed his name to Paul, right? And Paul changes and says, "Who are you? I'm Jesus." Da da da. And then he's like, that he changes sides. Paul develops a full theology of why Jesus had to die, and why he had to be resurrected, and why this whole story had to occur. The bottom lines are as follows, really in very broad details, because there's so many details and variations and interpretations, but big adult. According to Paul, man, by virtue of the fact that he is made up both of matter and form, of soul and body, is a conflicted being. This is before Freud. Another Jew came up with the word of conflict. He's a conflicted being. His materiality causes him to sin. His spirituality doesn't want to sin. So the question is, how does God solve that problem? How does God guarantee for man spiritual salvation in the next world? So he tried by picking one group of people and giving them the instructions, right? He gave them how to live and to sort of suppress the evil inclination and to be able to therefore be saved. But like most guys, the Jews didn't read the instructions. They refused to read the manual, and they were an absolute total blowout. It was just a total failure. And God, so God said that's not going to work. So what he did was, this is, in a disputation between the Ramban and a convert and a Meshumet whose name was, Meshumet. Otherwise you have to say a former Jew. And a Meshumet named Paul Christian. Only Jews take names like that, by the way. When they have to prove something. Like you have these bombastic names like Paulus de Sancta Maria, Paul of St. Mary. You can sure the guy's name was Shlomo Halevi, right? Because Goy doesn't have to prove anything, right? Just a Jew has to take a name like that. Always made me wonder whether Fletcher Christian actually had Jewish, like, antecedents or something. Wouldn't that be cool? Mutiny on the Bounty. Anyways. Ramban in this disputation, 1263, says to the king, he said, when talking about the virgin birth, he says, listen, you know, you've grown up, you were raised with this, so you can believe it, but, you know, for this is Bubba Weiss, we can't wrap our heads around this. So the same thing over here. So I'm going to tell you what he says, and I'm not expecting you to take it. Don't ask me what sense does that make, because I'm not here to try to convince you, right? Basically, he said like this. People are lost. By virtue of the fact that they're born with their the Adam's curse, they're born with their materiality and they're at the Eitz Hara and with their sexuality, there's no way to save them. The only way to save them would be by a miracle. And what would that miracle be? God himself had to become a person and accumulate endless schuyot, which can then be given, because God doesn't need the schuyot, endless chuyot to be given to people, and they can therefore use it as a sort of tow truck to get them out of the muck of their materiality, and by associating themselves by faith with those chuyot, they can get up. That's the bottom line. Man's efforts won't help. All you can do is, you know, sort of hit yourself to Jesus' wagon, and he'll schlep you out of the muck. The result of that is, but there was the Torah, and there was the Tanakh, and there's the Jews, and the eternal promise to the Jews. So says Paul, the Jews are the physical recipients of God's promise. Okay? But they failed. If you look, but the salvation that I'm promising you, or that Jesus is promising you, is spiritual. So therefore, we have to spiritualize everything. If you go underneath, if you read between the lines, if you remove the literal meaning of the Bible, you will find that the entire message that I'm telling you is there. You just have to look for it. And just as all of the laws and stories and things in the Bible, excuse me, are to be taken spiritually, non-literally, similarly, so therefore there's no milah, no mitzvahs, no nothing, it's all symbols, or allegories. Similarly, there's no more Jewish people. We don't need the physical Jewish people. We need the spiritual Jewish people. They are the verus Israel. They are the real Israel. And they're the ones to whom all the promises in the Bible are given. Okay? With the expectation, therefore, that the Jews would either become or disappear. There is this built-in expectation in Christian writings that the Jews will disappear, and as we'll see in a minute, that becomes a problem because we don't. I mean, you know, we don't cooperate, we don't get with the program, and we don't cooperate with what's expected of us. What can you do? Okay? That raises a few other questions, which are equally important in terms of how now Christians are going to look at Jews. Why are they still here? Why did they mess up so badly? Why did they want Jesus to die, according to the story in the gospel? What is it about them? I mean, how does this work? And not only that, you tell me, Paul, that everything in the Bible is to be spiritualized. Well, show me. And in fact, from Paul onward, the major thrust of all Christian writings, whether in Greek or in Latin or in Ethiopic, it doesn't matter, are aimed towards interpreting the Tanakh to prove Christian ideals. Sometimes when they are working on ideas which were originally Jewish, there's something of a hook that they can use. Sometimes it gets to be totally bizarre, but if you come with your faith commitment in advance, and you start seeing things that the average person wouldn't see. I'll give you a few examples of how this might work. The classic example, anybody know, of how you can prove Jesus' death and the suffering from the Bible is the passage in Isaiah 53 about the suffering servant of God, that he suffers for your sins. Now, the idea that a tzaddik could suffer, or whatever, could suffer for the sins of somebody else is a Jewish concept. It does exist. Okay? Not that the Son of God or God himself or whatever, but it does exist as an ideal. In fact, the Rav used to point out that twice a year we memorialize the Asarat HaRugei Malchut. We do it once on Tisha B'Av in the kina called Arzei Halbanon, and we do it once on Yom Kippur in the piyut called Eile Eskara. Yafeh. Why on each occasion? So on Tisha B'Av it's because of Avelis for Chachmei Yisrael that died or were killed on Kiddush Hashem. Why on Yom Kippur? So the Rav actually had two opinions on the top. Occasion is Misa Sadikim is Mechaper. The death of the righteous does provide kapar for the rest of the community. There's a horrific example of this that came up in World War II. According to Rav, I forget the name, but Rabbi Ephraim Oshri. So Rabbi Ephraim Oshri, lived in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. He wrote, Shelot Teshuvot Mimama Akim, Teshuvos from the Holocaust. So he's the one, actually he was. He was a witness to the last moments of Rebbe Chana Wasserman, Hashem Yikom Damo, before they took out his yeshiva, his brother of his yeshiva, to be murdered in the 9th fort, or 10th fort, there's some debate, in Kovna. According to this report, Rebbe Chanan said, we are now going to be karbonos for all of Klal Yisrael, and we shouldn't have machshevet psul, because we are going to attain kapara for our brethren in America. That's the way it's reported. So it was late in 1941, you have this idea, it's there, okay? There were two ways of interpreting who the suffering servant of God, Eved Hashem HaSovel, in Yeshayahu Nun Gimel. One was actually, what did refer to the Messiah, although not that the Messiah would die, and the other one refers to Klal Yisrael, that we suffer for all the world. That theme comes up very strongly in, for example, in the, in Rav Yehuda Levi in Kuzari, where he says Kalev ben Haivarim ken Yisrael ben Haumot, we are like the heart of all the nations, we suffer from all the illnesses, and we're affected by everything that goes on in the world, and so on and so forth. It's a similar kind of idea. There is clear, it's clear that Chazal, once the Christians, you know, sort of seized on this Messiah attribution of Eved Hashem HaSovel, they sort of like said, we can't go in that direction. We don't want to feed Christian distortions of genuine Jewish things. That's one kind of thing. Sometimes the proofs are cute. Example cute. At least they're ingenious. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Three is one. Three names of God is one. May prove the Trinity. Very nice. Okay. That's good if you're a Christian. No Jew's gonna buy that. Sometimes it got to be even silly. There's a very good example of where the Christian polemicists actually adopted, Jewish modes of interpretation of Hebrew. So there's a thing called Notarikon where you break words into, abbreviations. So, one Christian polemicist ostensibly told a Jew that the first word in the Torah is proof of Jesus. Why? Ben Breshit, Ben Ruach Av, Shloshtam Yachat Mimim. Okay, very nice. So, Ben Ruach Av, Shloshtam Yachat Mimim. The three of them together are one, they're perfect. The Jew says, that's nothing. Ba Rasha Echad, Shmo Yeshu, Taluhu. You can do all kinds of things with the same thing. In any event. So that was one thing that they did. Another thing, but then the question became, okay, why were the Jews so, why didn't the Jews recognize the truth? Why did they reject Jesus? We'll come back to that in a second. The third question is, what is the status of the Jews now? What happens now? So here enters the doctrine, a word which is going to be very, very important, for the entire 5 weeks, and that word is supersessionism. Taking over. Supersede. You were here, now I've taken your place. Supersession. All right. You would now, in other words, Christianity is now Judaism. We'll see that Islam takes the place of Judaism as well. And then the question is, once it takes its place, what status, if any, does Judaism have? Okay, we'll see that. Paul did not write systematic theology. He wrote letters, but mostly to Jews, actually. Which, because his first address for proselytizing and apostolizing was the Jewish communities of the diaspora, which were woefully ignorant Jewishly, had generally very good Greek and Hellenistic educations, and Paul's theology could easily be seen as overwhelmingly Greek and semi-pagan, and as opposed to genuinely Jewish. Recently, in fact, it has been argued, and I think very cogently, by two scholars at Tel Aviv. One of the questions that preoccupies medieval historians is, where'd all the Jews go? In other words, or modern historians. At the time of the destruction of the temple, it is estimated there were 12 million Jews in the world. 8 million in the Roman Empire. We know that more or less from tax rates and stuff like that. And let's say another million or two, 10 million Jews, Jews in the world. Let's say another million or two in Babylonia. That's 70 CE. 1900 years later, almost exactly, in 1789, there were 1.3 million Jews in the world. 900,000 Ashkenazim, 400,000 Sephardim. What happened? Where'd they all go? You can't murder that many. That's the invention of modernity. So it's pretty clear by the early Middle Ages, by the time Islam and Christianity have conquered the West, that the Jewish communities are very, very small. I mean, the Ashkenazi Jewish community is tiny. Maybe 50,000 Ashkenazim in the world at the time of Rashi. Teeny tiny communities. Hundreds of thousands in the Muslim world. So in other words, from the beginning of the Middle Ages until the end of the Middle Ages, beginning of the modern period, the numbers don't shift all that drastically, although there is a flip. Until around 100, there was an overwhelming majority of Sephardim, or Edot HaMizrach, and a teeny tiny minority of Ashkenazim, and then it flips, as you say, almost 2-1 in terms of 1789. Then we get up to 1939, we get up to 18 million, or maybe more. In the Shoah, 6 to 8 million get murdered, and now they talk about 12 to 14, although there's a tremendous amount of water they put in the soup when they give those figures. I mean, they're counting the second cousin of the dog that used to belong to the, you know, guy who was once Jewish or married to, you know, this kind of thing. In any event, where'd they all go? So these two scholars at Tel Aviv have argued recently that that over the course of the 200 years or so after the destruction of the temple, they just assimilated. Millions assimilated. A, due to the shock of the destruction of the temple, because that was generally their only tie to Yiddishkeit. They were woefully ignorant religiously. Woefully ignorant. And that's the reason why, for example, that Reb Meir, who says that the day that they translated the Bible into Greek is as bad as the day that they worshiped, that they created the golden calf. Because that basically said that you don't have to know Hebrew anymore. And that cuts you off from being able to be sustained by the centers in Eretz Israel and in Babylonia but they knew the Bible in Greek, and here comes Paul with a message in Greek, which is much more culturally attuned to what they're used to. And if it sounds familiar in terms of the Pew study, I sometimes find the parallels to be frightening. But in any event, he addresses in one of his letters the question of what is the status of the Jews today. So he says, this is in Hebrews book 8. Now the point in which we are saying is this. We have such a high priest. This is after the temple. This is before the temple is destroyed. We have a high priest, better than the one in Jerusalem, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the Majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. In other words, he's in heaven, Jesus. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus, it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. Let's skip. But so who are we talking about? We're talking about Christ has obtained a ministry that is much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises, because it can't be undone. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. And then, for God himself finds fault with them when he says, and he quotes a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant, Brit Chadashah, with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day that I took them out by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, for they did not continue in my covenant, so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord." In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete, and which is not pshat and pasuk. Pshat and pasuk is it's a renewal, but all right. But what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. In other words, Jews, out, finished, done. That's finished. We are now Beirus Israel. We are now the true Israel. The Jews should, in fact, go and disappear. Or become Christians. Now, by the way, so, and that is that until 20 years ago was the official Catholic line and overwhelmingly the Protestant line. Okay? That the Jews have, and they finished their historical task, and now they should take off. The problem was that the Jews didn't get with the program, as I mentioned. And the more time went on, the bigger the continued existence of the Jew, the more seriously the problem they had. I'm going to put this. The more the continued existence of the Jew was seen as a theological problem. Why is he still here? Why, and they don't go away quietly. It's a matter of like they're making noise and they compete with Christians for converts. There was a period of time, especially in the diaspora, the Jews were aggressive missionaries among the pagans. We know, for example, a few years before at the time of Paul, we know, for example, that the Emperor Claudius actually expelled the Jews from Rome twice. Because they were busy converting pagans to Judaism, away from, Plautus was a very firm pagan, so he didn't want people to stop worshipping the gods, and the Jews were actively proselytizing. More than that, you know, it's always a Jew under every rock. The person who's most famous for the second earliest campaign for urban renewal was the Emperor Nero, right? He took a match, made a scratch, no more dry goods store to be able to rebuild Rome in his own taste. After he burnt down Rome and many people actually died in the flames, he had to blame somebody. He's not going to say, I did this. So he wanted to blame the Jews, because everybody hates the Jews anyways, Tom Lehrer always said. He was going to blame the Jews. But as we know historically, he didn't blame the Jews, he blamed the Christians for the fire of Rome. Anybody, if you've ever seen the movie Quo Vadis, which describes all of these events with Peter and so on and so forth, he blames the Christians. It's the first really out-and-out anti-Christian persecution in Roman history. What made him change his mind? Oh, so it appears, is that his wife Poppaea convinced him, don't blame the Jews, blame the Christians. What's in it? What was in it for Poppaea? It's according to Josephus and according to Suetonius, Poppaea was a Gioret Tzedek. And she didn't want him to blame the Jews. But nobody likes these Christians and nobody takes them seriously anyways. So she says, go blame the Christians. So that's not something you want to tell, you know, like your Christian friends, that ultimately the first Christian persecution happened as a result of we trying to save Jews. But that, she was apparently a Gioret Tzedek and married to Nero. It's kind of a funny intermarriage. But no more funny than, no more odd than Achashverosh and Esther, I suppose. And so on. But it's typical of the fact that the Jews were actually competing with Christians for converts. There were indications in the third century that in fact there were riots between Jews and Christians as to who can convert more, pagans and who has the real truth and so on and so forth. In any event, as time goes on, Christianity gains the upper hand, especially when it comes to a head in the year 312, 313, when the Emperor Constantine converts to Christianity. He does not make Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. That only happens about 50, 60 years later. But he does make it a register, the preferred religion, and he basically puts churchmen in charge of all kinds of areas of Roman life, including determining the status of the Jew. From that time on, Christianity is on the ascent. Okay. And as time goes on, one of the things that the Christian councils had developed during the interim, during the period before it was Christianity was recognized, was to develop an entire attitude of how should we deal with Jews? Generally, the theme was stay away from them. Don't socialize with them, don't marry them, don't eat with them, separate them as much as possible. Part of that, by the way, was for the sake of the Christians, which I'll get to in a minute. But also in order to emphasize that the Jews are separate and also not undesirable, and that Jews should not serve in positions of authority over Christians, which would give the impression that Jews are better than Christians or even equal to Christians. But Jews have to be put in their place to embody, literally, their status as once they've been rejected, their covenant dissolved, and ultimately have to be punished for the fact that they accepted collective responsibility, according to the gospel, for the death of Jesus for all time. Okay. And they still don't go away. In the year 410, okay, Rome is sacked by Goths. Rome is no longer what it used to be, but it's still a very potent symbol. And the fall of Rome and the sack of Rome by the Goths sent a tremor throughout the entire Roman world. I don't know if it's a fair comparison, but I think it is actually. You could compare the sack of Rome to the fall of the Twin Towers. Not so much for the amount of people who were killed, but for the symbolism of hitting something that embodied American commercial power and presence. Rome falls is like something nobody it was unimaginable. One of the people who was deeply affected by this idea of the vulnerability of Rome was a man whose name was Augustine of Hippo. Hippo is a city in North Africa in what is today Morocco. And he was from upper class Roman family, very extremely well educated, whose mother convinced him to convert to Christianity. And he became the bishop of the Christians in Hippo. He was a first-rate philosopher and thinker, and the awareness of the fall, of the vulnerability of what do we call Rome? Orbs aeterna, the eternal city. The fact that Rome is vulnerable it got him to ask himself, okay, this is what happens to the city of man. What would the city of God look like? What would the republic, Christian republic, if we're wiping out all the pagans, Christianity is the way, there's no other way, that's the only way of salvation, we'll come to that next time. What will the ultimate Christian world look like? You know, what are we striving for now that we see the vulnerability of what man has wrought? So he writes this enormous magnum opus called Civitas Dei, the city of God, and he lays out he talks about everything, politics and economics and theology, everything under the sun. So within that context, he also has to deal with the question of, is there a place for Jews in the city of God? If you read Paul, they were supposed to have gone already. So why are they still here? So one could argue that they should be persecuted, or one could come to the conclusion, you know something? I don't know why, but what do you see from it? What do you see from it? What you see from it is the fact that apparently the Jews perhaps still have a positive function in Christian society. Otherwise, they would be gone. Okay. Which is something of a philo-Semitic shift, and there's a big debate about among historians, whether Augustine was anti-Jewish or neutral or whatever. He lays down his thoughts in one important paragraph or chapter of his book, City of God, book 18, chapter 46. This is only part of it. He starts by describing Jesus' life. While Herod therefore reigned in Judea, and Caesar Augustus was emperor at Rome, the state of the republic being already changed, meaning it's now an empire, and the world being set at peace by him, Christ was born in Bethlehem of Judah, man manifest out of a human virgin. But the Jews who slew him, and who would not believe in him, because it behooved him to die and rise again. This is one of the tensions, by the way, you have here. Why blame the Jews if he's supposed to die? Like Akasha, were yet more miserably wasted by the Romans and utterly rooted out from their kingdom. This is another important piece. The destruction of the temple and the exile are interpreted by the Christians as a sign, as a punishment which came upon them for rejecting Jesus. This is one of the reasons why, for up until relatively recently, and now it's coming back, it's sort of going into reverse, it was not possible for believing Christians who were not evangelicals to accept the idea of a Jewish state because the exile of the Jew was divine punishment for the murder of Jesus and his rejection. Okay? Based not infrequently on the pasuk lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda mechokek mi bein raglav ad ki yavo Shiloh v'lo yikatamim Shiloh, they interpret as the Messiah. Jews can have sovereignty until the Messiah comes, and then ois. Another ramification of that, by the way, is that Jews also don't belong in the places of their residence. One of the things that Christians and Jews used to agree on was the fact we don't belong. But the Jews thought that eventually we would go home, and they say, no, you will never go home because you have to be punished. So you're in limbo forever. Where aliens had already ruled over them and were dispersed throughout the lands, so that indeed there is no place where they are not, and are thus by their own scriptures a testimony to us that we have not forged the prophecy about Christ. In other words, the exile proves the veracity of the gospel narratives and the writings of Paul about the rejection or the dissolution of the covenant. And very many of them, considering this, even before his passion, but chiefly after his resurrection, believed in him of whom it was predicted, though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, the remnant shall be saved. There's always a few smart Jews who become Christians. But the rest are blinded, of whom it was predicted, let their table be made for them a trap, their retribution and a stumbling block. Let their eyes be darkened lest they see and bow down their back away. This is the first example of which I'm aware, or an early example of the doctrine of kaikitas judaeorum, Jewish blindness. Jews refuse to see the truth, and it might be that the word kaik is derived from the word kaikitas. Jews refuse to see the truth. Now, are they blinded by God? Do they blind themselves? Who does that? We'll see that in a minute. Therefore, when they do not believe our scriptures, their own, which they blindly read, are fulfilled in them. What do you mean they blindly read? If you're blind, you can't read. This is before Louis Braille. So what's pshat? They only read the literal meaning. They don't understand the deeper meaning that we have shown from the time of Paul onward. Lest perchance anyone should say that the Christians have forged these prophecies about Christ, which are quoted under the name of the Sibyl and of others, if there are such be who do not belong to the Jewish people. In other words, so the Jews hold on to these books that they themselves don't understand. For us indeed, those suffice which are quoted from the books of our enemies, to whom we make our acknowledgement on account of this testimony, which in spite of themselves contribute by their possession of these books, which while they themselves are dispersed among the nations, wherever the Church of Christ is spread abroad. Again, bottom line, they are our enemies, but they preserve the works that prove our legitimacy. For a prophecy about this thing was said, okay, now. For a prophecy about this thing, about the positive educational rule, function, which the Jews serve in their dispersion, in their exile, ruled by Christians, was sent before in the Psalms, which were written by who? Who is the ancestor of Jesus? Right? Which they also read, where it is written, "My God, His mercy," this is Psalms 59. "His mercy shall prevent me. My God has shown me concerning mine enemies, for thou shalt not slay them, lest they should forget thy law, disperse them in thy might." What does that mean? Al tahargem pen yishkechu ami. Don't kill the Jews, lest my people forget. All of the good things in the Bible are Christian. All of the bad things in the Bible are Jews. Hebrews are good. Jews are bad. All the positive figures in the Bible are prefigurations of Jesus. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the whole chevra, right? All of the bad things prefigure the Jews. Now, if you were going to have a profile of a people based on all of the tochachot in the Nevi'im and in the Torah, that's who the Jew is. Think of all the miserable things that all the bad things that the Nevi'im commit. That's who we are. Because all the good things are prefigure Jesus. By the way, if you take a look if you go to the Sistine Chapel, it's striking. In the middle of the ceiling, they have the entire, they have the Genesis narrative. Around on the outside are the prophets of Israel, and the inside is evangelists. You have to get through, from a special point of view, you have to get through the Hebrew prophets, then mediated through the evangelists to get to the true story of the creation. That's what Michelangelo was trying to get across. Mm-hmm. It's a visualization of this theological point that you get to salvation through proper reading of the prophets who prefigure or predict Jesus, and then as mediated through the evangelists, and then you get to the truth. Okay, so the Jews should be kept alive. Now, why? Because what are people going to forget? They're going to forget the original law. They're going to forget the original Torah, which the Jews have in Hebrew, what's called the Hebraica Veritas, the Hebrew truth. And even though they don't know what they've got, they're preserving it for us. Okay, following. So Jews serve as. We'll see in a minute what the ramifications of this are. Serve as a. As a living educational function. They fulfill an educational function within Christian society, lest my people forget, and that is ensured by their dispersion. Okay. There is a hint of animosity in this, more than a hint, perhaps. Al tahargem, slay them not. Now, what's odd about that statement from a Christian point of view? Or from a lexical point of view? From a point of view of the words?
The assumption that everyone wants to slay them?
Or you should! If God has to come out of his way, then, what do you mean? What's shot? You would want to! Why would you want to? Because if they're such monsters, and they murdered Jesus, and they accepted responsibility, and they refused, and they reject him, so obviously, you know, like, no, don't do it. In this verse, at least the way I read it, or in this passage, you have the ongoing tension between Augustine's giving the right of Jews to live and continue their lives the way that they do, and the sort of like abyss of hostility, which is built into the narrative of Jesus' life, the way they receive it, with the Jews chasing him and persecuting him and screaming for his blood. It's there. It's a built-in construct. Which Augustine says, don't. But when it overflows, it doesn't come from an inauthentic place. Because Jesus is a very, very intimate part of Christian, and his suffering of Christian spirituality. When Mel Gibson came out with, what's it called, The Crucifixion of the Christ, a friend of mine went to see the movie, and I couldn't. But I think it's on YouTube now, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. I saw a little clip of it. Every single drop of blood that comes off of his side or whatever, people in the audience were crying and were on their knees and whatever, because that's their salvation, is every single drop of blood that Jesus had on the cross. But who did it? At the end of the day. It's not for nothing that during Holy Week, from Palm Sunday to Easter, Jews were kept off the streets. It wasn't just because they don't want to see Jews. It was actually for their own good. Okay? So you have the tension of the sort of murderous tension and a sort of very tolerant kind of thing that they have to be preserved in order to be able to fulfill this function. And therefore he has not slain them. That is, he has not let the knowledge that they are Jews be lost in them, although they have been conquered by the Romans, lest they should forget the law of God, and their testimony should be of no avail in this matter to of which we treat. But it was not enough that he should say, slay them not lest they forgot their law, unless he had added, disperse them. Because if they had only been in their own land with the testimony of the Jews and not everywhere, certainly the church which is everywhere could not have had them as witnesses along all nations to the prophecies which were sent before concerning Christ. So the exile is built into this. Okay. This is known as the doctrine of Augustinian doctrine of testimony. The function of the Jew is to continue to exist and to give testimony to something. Now that testimony to something subdivides to a number of things. Number one, the Jew is the only identifiable actor from the gospel narratives who's still around. Some guy in Finland said, how do I know this story is true? No. Look at the Jews. Same Jews, same guys. So it verifies the story, which is also already hinted at by Augustine, number one. Number two, the Jew continues, despite the fact that his covenant is over and his understanding of the Bible is wrong, the Jew continues to live according to the literal interpretation of the Bible. He is what, called Living Letters of the Law, which is the name of a book by Jeremy Cohen from Tel Aviv University. He lives literally according to the way the Bible says. In other words, the Jew is sort of like, for those of you who come from New York, sort of like Old Bethpage, Old Sturbridge Village, or for Israelis, Na'ot Kedumim, or what goes on in the national parks in Sipori and Bet Shan. He's living in a museum. He lives in a museum. You want to see what was before Jesus? Go look at the Jew. He lives in a time warp. Okay? Come back. I'm going to come to Amos Oz in a minute. He lives in a... if you want to see what used to be, you can see the Jew. Number one. By the way, that got the Jew into trouble. That got the Jews into trouble later because the Christians always thought that Jews lived according to only what's written in the Torah. When they discovered there's a Gemara and a Torah Shebal Peh, and it's got nothing, and it's very different than what's written, that started a whole nother stage of Jewish-Christian relations, but it's not for now. Number three. So that's number one. Number two. Number three. The Jew is to be kept in reduced circumstances with no rights or with limited rights, with limited opportunities in order to embody the fact that he is a rejected being. Now that wasn't always enforced because it depended on the secular governments and sometimes the Jews were desirable and sometimes they were needed and. But officially speaking, Jews were to be kept in second class status. There was no citizenship, but you were either Christian or you weren't Christian. Second class status to embody what his rejected state. Number four, he's supposed to be a living letter. He's supposed to be an embodiment of the literal. He's a testimony by the virtue of the fact that I will ultimately pressure him by keeping him in reduced circumstances that may induce him to convert. In other words, it's lachatz psychologi lomatun put on the Jew to get him to convert. That's also the ultimate validation. So the Jews, Christians were always stuck. The Jews are rejected, but they're desperate to have Jews convert because that's the ultimate validation. It's sort of constant tension. I'm summarizing from subsequent literature and then stuff like that. Okay. We're not going to get to the last two texts, so I'll close with one of the reasons why it's important to be literate. About 21 years ago, this past summer, I was on the faculty of the Wexner Heritage Foundation seminar in Israel because I taught for them for a good 8 years before that. And there was a symposium about, we were in the happy days of Oslo, right, before the buses started blowing up. A few buses had already blown up, but not quite. We hadn't gotten to the really good times yet. There was a symposium about the peace that's coming, And and there were three people participated in the symposium. The symposium was actually, I remember, I forget, was emceed by Professor Arnie Eisen, who's the head of JTS today. At that time, he was at Stanford. And the two speakers, one was Eliakim Etzni from Kiryat Arba, and the other one was Amos Oz. It was striking. It was an amazing, amazing event for a number of reasons. Number one, Oz, the champion of democracy, refused to sit next to Etzni. He said, Haetzni is a monster, Haetzni is horrible, I won't sit next to him, so Arnie Eisen had to sit in the middle. In fact, throughout the entire panel discussion, Oz wouldn't even look at Haetzni, who was, he's secular, by the way, but as a secular nationalist, one of the founders of Kiryat Arba. More interestingly, and Haetzni went on and on and on about how it's important that Jews have their own country and that we should have our own ethnic identity and we should have our own culture and so on and so forth. Okay, stuff that at the time was considered to be very, very gauche. Then O spoke. And O said the following. I'll never forget it as long as I live. He said, the choice that faces us today can be compared to the contrast between the old city of Jerusalem and the new city of Jerusalem. The old city of Jerusalem is a museum. It's an old way of, old, passé, anachronistic way of living, and nobody wants to live in a museum. New City of Jerusalem is live theater, with all the options that are open, where there's room for vision and peace and so on and so forth. So the choice is between living in a museum and living in live theater. I was sitting there and my jaw dropped. Because basically what Oz was saying was, he was invoking Augustine's view of Jews and Jewish history and Judaism and saying that's what's really true and we have to get past it for the vision of the broader, shall I use the word, salvation that is posed by peace and whatever they were, hoping to achieve. And I wasn't, and when I was sitting there, then after that, a few things, my thoughts then went something in this order, if I remember correctly. Number one was, does he know what he's saying? Is he educated enough to know that he's actually invoking the Augustine image of the, fossilized Jew, as Toynbee would put it? If he doesn't, then it's sad. And just as sad is the fact that I was the only one in the room who caught the reference. When I mentioned it to a few other people that were colleagues, they said, oh wow, they didn't like think of it, fine. They knew. But the average, they were actually members and some Israelis in the room didn't have a clue what he was drawing on for a source of inspiration. So it's, shows you that, in fact, history is aktuali. And we'll see more examples. No, because at the time, first of all, I was trying to be polite. And second of all, at the time, I don't know if you remember, but before Rabin was murdered, there was no way you could say anything against the peace without being shouted down and screamed at, and afterwards it wasn't any better, especially for those of us taught at Bar-Ilan. But as a matter of fact, I remember actually, and this kept going on till the second Intifada. I mean, for example, I remember I once spoke to in 1998, 1999, I spoke to a group of teachers from Histadrut HaMorim and talked about the Muslim view of Judaism. And one of the teachers, one of the senior teachers, came up to me and said, oh, you're giving us all these lakshin that Shuka Parat is saying. Shuka Parat is one of the leading Orientalists, students of Arab and Muslim culture in the country. He's retired from Hebrew University. So he clearly knew what he was talking about. But the inability to be able to hear anything other than, what they wanted to hear was patent. So put that to the 10th power before Rabin was murdered, it was not possible to say anything.
In what context do the Christians use the phrase New Jerusalem?
Same concept. Although the Christians have to understand the New Jerusalem is a spiritual Jerusalem. It is not the city. Christians,